From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Johnny Cash would have been 78 today, and today the sixth and final album in Cash's American recording series was released.
It's a long and a dusty road, a hard and a heavy load, and the folks that I meet ain't always kind. Some are bad, some are good, some have done the best they could, and some have tried to ease my troubled mind.
On today's Fresh Air, we feature our 1997 interview with Johnny Cash, and we'll hear from Rick Rubin, who produced the American recording series, working with Cash from 1994 until his death in 2003. And film critic David Edelstein reviews the French movie A Prophet, which is nominated for an Oscar. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today would have been Johnny Cash's 78th birthday, and the final album in Cash's series, American Recordings, was released today. Produced by Rick Rubin, the series features Cash singing a mix of traditional ballads, his own songs, and moody cover versions of songs by artists ranging from Leonard Cohen and Loudon Wainwright to Beck and Nine Inch Nails. Rubin and Cash started the series in 1994. This final album features songs recorded between 2002 and Cash's death in September 2003. He died at the age of 71. We're going to hear interviews I recorded with Cash and with Rubin. Let's start with a song from the new album. This is Redemption Day, written by Sheryl Crow.
I've wept for those who suffer long, but how I weep for those who've gone. In rooms of grief and question wrong, but keep on killing. It's in the soul to feel such things, but weak to watch without speaking. Oh, what mercy sadness brings, if God be willing. There is a train that's heading straight to heaven's gate. And on the way, child and man and woman wait, watch and wait for Redemption Day. Fire rages in the streets and swallows everything it meets.
Johnny Cash's American Recording series introduced him to a generation of listeners too young to remember him for such hits as I Walk the Line, Ring of Fire, and Folsom Prison Blues. I spoke with Johnny Cash in 1997, after the publication of his autobiography, just days before he announced that he had been diagnosed with a neurological disorder, which was a complication of diabetes and eventually resulted in respiratory failure. I'm so grateful I had this chance to talk with him. You grew up during the Depression. What are some of the things that your father did to make a living while you were a boy?
My father was a cotton farmer first, and but he didn't have any land, or what land he had, he lost it in the Depression. So he worked as a woodman and cut pulpwood for the paper mills, rode the rails in boxcars, going from one harvest to another to try to make a little money picking fruit or vegetables. Did every kind of work imaginable, from painting to shoveling to herding cattle. He's always been such an inspiration to me because of the very kinds of things that he did and the kind of life he lived. He inspired me so that all the things he did, so far from being a soldier in World War I to being an old man in his patio sitting on the porch watching the dogs, you know, I think about his life and it would inspire me to go my own other direction. And I just like to explore minds and the desires of the people out there.
You know, it's interesting that you say your father inspired you so much. I'm sure you wouldn't have wanted to lead his life picking cotton.
I did. Until I was 18 years old, that is.
Mm-hmm.
Then I picked the guitar, and I've been picking it since.
Right. Did you have a plan to get out? Did you very much want to get out of the town where you were brought up and get out of picking cotton?
Yeah, I knew that when I left there at the age of 18, I wouldn't be back.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of common knowledge among all the people there that when you graduate from high school here, you go to college or go get a job or something and do it on your own. And having been familiar with hard work, it was no problem for me. But first I hitchhiked to Pontiac, Michigan, and got a job working in Fisher Body, making those 1951 Pontiacs. I worked there 3 weeks, got really sick of it, went back home and joined the Air Force.
You have such a wonderful, deep voice. Did you start singing before your voice changed?
Oh, yeah. I got no deep voice today. I've got a cold. But when I was so young, I had a high tenor voice. I used to sing Bill Monroe songs, and I sing Dennis Day songs. Like
oh, no.
Sang on the, yeah, songs that he sang on the Jack Benny show.
Wow.
Every week he sang an old Irish folk song. And next day in the fields, I'd be singing that song if I was working in the fields. And I always loved those songs, and with my high tenor, I thought I was pretty good, you know, almost as good as Dennis Day. But when I was 17, 16, my father and I cut wood all day long, and I was swinging that crosscut saw and hauling wood. And when I walked in the back door late that afternoon, I was singing, "Everybody gonna have religion and glory. Everybody gonna be singing a story." I sang those old gospel songs for my mother, and she said, "Is that you?" And I said, "Yes, ma'am." And she came over and put her arms around me and said, "God's got his hands on you." I still think of that, you know?
You left home when you were about 18. And then how old were you when you actually went to Memphis?
Well, I went to Memphis after I finished the Air Force in 1954.
Mm-hmm.
I lived on that farm until I went to the Air Force. I was in there four years, and when I came back, I got married and moved to Memphis. Got an apartment. Started trying to sell appliances at a place called Home Equipment Company, but I couldn't sell anything and didn't really want to. All I wanted was the music, and if somebody in the house was playing music when I would go come, I would stop and sing with them. Like one time, Gus Cannon, the man who wrote Walk Right In,
mm-hmm.
which was a hit for the Rooftop Singers. And I sat on the front porch with him day after day when I found him and sing those songs.
When you got to Memphis, Elvis Presley had already recorded That's All Right. Sam Phillips had produced him for his label, Sun Records. You called Sam Phillips and asked for an audition. Did it take a lot of nerve to make that phone call?
No, it just took the right time. I was fully confident that I was going to see Sam Phillips and to record for him. That when I called him, I thought, I'm going to get on Sun Records. So I called him, and he turned me down flat. Then 2 weeks later, I called, turned down again. He told me over the phone that he couldn't sell gospel music, so because it was independent, not a lot of money, you know. So I didn't press that issue, but one day I just decided I'm ready to go. So I went down with my guitar and sat on the front steps of his recording studio and met him when he came in. And I said, "I'm John Cash. I'm the one that's been calling. And if you'd listen to me, I believe you'd be glad you did." And he said, "Come on in." Well, that was a good lesson for me, you know, to believe in myself.
So what did Phillips actually respond to most of the songs that you played him?
He responded most to a song of mine called Hey Porter, which was on the first record. But he asked me to go write a love song or maybe a bitter weeper. So I wrote a song called Cry, Cry, Cry. Went back in and recorded that for the other side of the record.
Everybody knows where you go when the sun goes down. I think you only live to see the lights uptown. I wasted my time when I would try, try, try. 'Cause when the lights have lost their glow, you'll cry, cry, cry. Soon your sugar daddies will all be gone. You wake up some cold day and find you're alone. You'll call for me, but I'm gonna tell you bye, bye, bye. When I turn around and walk away, you'll cry, cry, cry. You're gonna cry, 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 and you'll cry alone. When everyone's forgotten and you're left on your own, you're gonna cry, cry, cry.
So, this record was the beginning of your recording career. What was it like when you started to go on tour? You know, after coming from the cotton fields, it's true, I mean, you'd been in the Army and you'd been abroad, you know, with the Army. But what was it like for you in the early days of getting recognized, you know, traveling around the country?
Well, when I started playing concerts, I went out from Memphis to Arkansas, Louisiana, and Tennessee, played the little towns there that I would go out myself in my car and set up the show or get the show booked in those theaters. And then along about 3 months later, Elvis Presley asked me to sing with him at the Overton Park Shell in Memphis. And I sang Cry, Cry, Cry and Hey Porter. And from that time on, I was on my way, and I knew it, I felt it, and I loved it. So Elvis asked me to go on tour with him, and I did. I worked with Elvis four or five tours in the next year or so. And I was always intrigued by his charisma. You know, I just, you can't be in the building without Elvis, with Elvis, without looking at him, you know? And he inspired me so that with his fire and energy that I guess that inspiration from him really helped me to go.
It's funny. I think of your charisma and his charisma as being very different forms of charisma because, I mean, he would move around so much on stage, and I think of your charisma as being a very kind of still, stoic kind of charisma.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm an old man to him. I'm 4 years older than he was. So I was 23 when I started recording, and Elvis was 19. And I was married. He wasn't. So we didn't have a lot in common family life.
Mm-hmm.
But we liked each other and appreciated each other, so he asked me to tour with him.
Did you want that kind of adulation that he was getting from girls who would come see him?
I don't remember if I wanted it, but I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I did. But I didn't. I only got it to a very small degree compared to Elvis.
I want to play what I think was your first big hit, I Walk the Line.
Mm-hmm. That was my third record.
And you wrote the song. Tell me the story of how you wrote it and what you were thinking about at the time.
In the Air Force, I had an old Wilcox K recorder. And used to hear guitar runs on that recorder going dun, 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 like the chords on I Walk the Line. And I always wanted to write a love song using that theme, you know, that tune. And so I started to write the song. And I was in Gladewater, Texas one night with Carl Perkins. And I said, I've got a good idea for a song. And I sang him the first verse that I had written. And I said, it's called Because You're Mine. And he said, I Walk the Line is a better title. So I changed it to I Walk the Line.
Now, were you thinking of your own life when you wrote this?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was kind of a prodding to myself to play it straight, Johnny.
And was this, I think I read that this was supposed to be a ballad. I mean, it was supposed to be slow when you first wrote it.
That's the way I sang it, yeah, at first. But Sam wanted it up, you know, up-tempo and... I put paper in the strings of my guitar to get that sound, and with a bass and a lead guitar, there it was, bare and stark, that song was, when it was released, and I heard it on the radio, and I really didn't like it, and I called Sam Phillips and asked him, please not send out any more records of that song.
Why?
But he laughed at me. I just didn't like the way it sounded to me. I didn't know it sounded that way, and I didn't like it. I don't know. But he said, let's give it a chance. And it was just a few days until that's all it took to take off.
Well, let's hear I Walk the Line. This is a great record. It was great then, and it still is. This is Johnny Cash.
Keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
You know, it's interesting. You've always or almost always worn black during your career. Mm-hmm. And I was interested in reading that your mother hated it, too.
See, yeah. Yes, you do.
See, we have something in common. Mm-hmm. Our mothers don't like black.
Right, I love it.
Me too. But you gave in for a while. She started making you bright, flashy outfits, even a nice white suit.
Mm-hmm.
What did it feel like for you to be on stage in bright colors or all in white?
Well, that was 1956, and I hadn't been wearing the black for very long. So it was okay. I would wear anything my mother made me, you know. I just couldn't afford to turn her down. But before long, I decided to start with the black and stick with it because it felt good to me on stage that a figure there in black and everything coming out of his face, that's the way I wanted to do it.
We'll hear more of our 1997 interview with Johnny Cash after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the 1997 interview I recorded with Johnny Cash. The final album in his American recording series was released today. I think it was in the late 1950s that you started doing prison concerts, which you eventually became very famous for.
Mm-hmm.
What got you started performing in prison?
Well, I had a song called Folsom Prison Blues that was the hit just before I walked the line. And the people in Texas heard about it at the state prison and got to write me letters asking me to come down there. So I responded, and then the warden called me and asked if I would come down and do a show for the prisoners in Texas. And so we went down, and there's a rodeo at all these shows that the prisoners have there. And in between the rodeo things, they asked me to set up and do two or three songs. So that was what I did. I did Folsom Prison Blues, which they thought was their song, you know. And I walked the line, ring, Hey Porter, cry, cry, cry. And then the word got around on the grapevine that Johnny Cash was all right and that you ought to see him. So the requests started coming in from other prisoners all over the United States. And then the word got around. So I always wanted to record that, you know, to record a show. Because of the reaction I got, it was far and above anything I had ever had in my life. The complete explosion of noise and reaction that they gave me with every song. So then I came back the next year and played the prison again, the New Year's Day show. Came back again the third year and did the show. And then I kept talking to my producers at Columbia about recording one of those shows. It was so exciting. I said that the people out there ought to share that, you know, and feel that excitement, too. So preacher friend, a friend of mine named Floyd Gressett set it up for us. And Lou Robin and a lot of other people involved at Folsom Prison. So we went into Folsom on February 11th, 1968, and recorded a show live.
Before we hear one of the tracks from that live album, tell me what it was. What kind of reaction surprised you the most when you were performing for prisoners?
Well, what really surprised me was any kind of prison song, I could do no wrong. You know, if it's whatever, the prisoner song or San Quentin, a song of mine. But they felt like they could identify with me, I suppose. I sang songs like Dark as a Dungeon or Bottom of a Mountain, songs about the working man and the hard life. And, of course, they'd been through the hard life, all of them, or they wouldn't be there. So they kind of related to all that, I guess, the songs I chose. Very little of love songs, very few. Mostly, you know, songs about the down and outer. And so then requests started coming in for me to go to other prisons, and it got overwhelming. So I decided I would do two or three, and I wouldn't do any more. But one thing, my wife was scared to death, and the other women on the show were too, so I decided not to. It was still a great experience to get on stage and perform those people.
Why don't we hear Folsom Prison Blues from your Live at Folsom Prison record? This is Johnny Cash.
Hello, I'm Johnny Cash.
I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling around a bend, and I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps a-rolling on down to San Antone. When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry.
We'll hear more of my 1997 interview with Johnny Cash in the second half of the show. The final album in his American recording series was released today. Today would have been his 78th birthday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Slow it!
I bet there's rich folks eating from a fancy dining car. They're probably drinking coffee and smoking big cigars. Well, I know I had it coming. I know I can't be free. But those people keep a moving, and that's what tortures me.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cabot Creamery Cooperative, makers of naturally aged Vermont cheddar cheese, and offering recipes, stories, and programs for schools at CabotCheese.coop. From the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And from Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals, from physicians and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. This is NPR.
Take one fresh and tender kiss.
Coming up, Rick Rubin talks about producing Johnny Cash's American recording series. Some of the sessions were recorded in Rubin's living room. The sixth and final album in the series has just been released. Also, we conclude our interview with Johnny Cash, and David Edelstein reviews the French film The Prophet, which is nominated for an Oscar.
Don't forget a small moonbeam. Fold it lightly with a dream. Your lips and mine to sip the wine. Memories are made of this. Then at the wedding bells, one house where lovers dwell, three little kids for the flavor. Stir carefully through the day, see how the flavor stays. These are the dreams that we will savor with his blessings from above.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Johnny Cash would have been 78 today. This is also the release date of the sixth and final album in his American recording series. Let's get back to the interview I recorded with Cash in 1997, after the publication of his autobiography. We talked about the American recording series. A few years ago, you started making records with Rick Rubin. Tell me how you and he first met up. It seemed initially like a very improbable match. He had produced a lot of rap records and produced the Beastie Boys and the Red Hot Chili Peppers. It would seem like a surprising match. It ended up being a fantastic match. How did he approach you?
Well, my contract with Mercury Polygram Nashville was about to expire, and I never had really been happy. The company, the record company, just didn't put any promotion behind me. I think one album, maybe the last one I did, they pressed 500 copies. And I was just disgusted with it. So I decided I'll just do my thing. I'll do my tours and writing, and that's all I need. So that's what I was trying to do. But I got hungry to be back in the studio, to be creative and put something down, you know, for the fans to hear. And about that time that I got to feeling that way, Lou Robin, my manager, came to me and talked to me about a man called Rick Rubin that he had been talking to that wanted me to sign with his record company. It was American Recordings. I said, I like the name, maybe it'd be okay. So I said, I'd like to meet the guy. I'd like for him to tell me what he can do with me that they're not doing now. So he came to my concert in Orange County, California. I believe this was like 83 when he first came. And listened to the show, and then afterwards I went in the dressing room and sat and talked to him. And, you know, he had his hair, I don't think it's ever been cut. And very, dresses like a hobo, usually, clean, but which kind of guy I really felt comfortable with, actually. I think I was more comfortable with him than I would have been with a producer with a suit on. But I said, what are you going to do with me that nobody else has been able to do to sell records with me? And he said, well, I don't know that we will sell records. He said, I would like you to go with me and sit in my living room with a guitar and two microphones and just sing to your heart's content everything you ever wanted to record. I said, that sounds good to me. So I did that. And day after day, 3 weeks, I sang for him. And when I finally stopped, he had been saying, like the last day or so, he'd been saying, now, I think we should put this one in the album. So without him saying, I want to record you and release an album, he started saying, let's put this one in the album. So the album, this big question, you know, began to take form, take shape. And Rick and I would weed out the songs. There were songs that didn't feel good to us that we would say, let's don't consider that one. And then we'd focus on the ones that we did like, that felt right and sounded right. And if I didn't like the performance on that song, I would keep trying it and do take after take until it felt comfortable with me and felt that it was coming out of me and my guitar and my voice as one, that it was right from my soul. That's how I felt about it. All those things in that first album, and I got really excited about it. But then we went into the studio and tried to record some with different musicians, and it didn't sound good. It didn't work. So we put together the album with just a guitar and myself.
Yeah, I was really glad you did it that way. There's something just so naked about it. There's something so just emotionally naked. And there's so much emotion in your voice. And it just all, you know, comes across really clearly.
Thank you.
I think these records and the touring that you've done with them has helped introduce you to a younger audience that wasn't around during your earlier hits and maybe knew your reputation but didn't really know your music very well. And I'm wondering what that experience has been like for you to play to younger audiences who are first getting acquainted with your music.
Oh, it feels like 1955 all over again. It really does. It really does. And the ones who've been into my new recordings are becoming familiar with some of the old stuff, like Folsom and I Walk the Line and Ring of Fire. And those songs now just really get a reaction like I did on my songs back in the 50s. But it feels so good with those young people and the adulation. I just love it. I've always been a big ham. I just eat it up. No, I'm very appreciative to them.
Johnny Cash, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
I want to say you're really good at what you do, and I appreciate you. Thank you.
Johnny Cash, recorded in 1997. The final album in his American Recording series, produced by Rick Rubin, was released today. I spoke with Rubin in 2004 after the release of a 5-CD box set of the Cash Rubin sessions called Unearthed. Before we hear the interview, here's a track from Unearthed.
Once my soul was astray from the heavenly way,
I was wretched and as vile as could be. But my Savior and love gave me peace from above when he reached down his hand for me. When my Savior reached down for me, when he reached down his hand for me, I was lost and undone without God or his Son when he reached down his hand for me.
One of the CDs in this new box set is just spirituals, spirituals and hymns. Solo, it's just Johnny Cash and his guitar, and I just particularly love this CD. They're so beautiful, and there's so much feeling on this. And I don't know if you'd listened to a lot of these kinds of songs before, so I'm interested in what the process was like for you of just hearing Johnny Cash sing spiritual after spiritual.
I thought it was beautiful, and it was interesting how it came about. Johnny had found, the title of that album is called My Mother's Hymn Book, and Johnny had found his mother's hymn book, the actual one that she sang him songs from the time he was born. And these are songs that he'd been singing since he was 4 years old, and they really helped form who he was as a person and as a singer. So he felt more connected to these songs, I think, than any songs he ever recorded before. And very second nature for him to play them.
While you were recording these songs, did it give you insights into Johnny Cash's relationship with religion and spirituality?
He's probably the most committed spiritual person I've ever met. He really lived his life according to his connection with God, really, and he had such an honest and pure way about it that I remember we had a dinner party at my house one night with Johnny and June and some musicians and some film directors. And before dinner, Johnny had everyone hold hands and he said a prayer and he read from the Bible. And I know some of the people at the table had never experienced that before, and some of the people at the table were even atheists. But his belief in what he believed was so strong that what you believed didn't matter so much because you were in the presence of someone who really believed, and that felt good, and that made you believe really in him more than anything else. It was really beautiful.
Why don't we hear I Shall Not Be Moved? I think a lot of people know this as a spiritual that was also used as a civil rights song. It was one of the anthems of the civil rights movement. I'm not sure I ever heard it sung this way before. What about you?
I don't think I have either.
And what did the song mean to him? Did he talk about it at all?
He asked my opinion and was not concerned, but didn't want to create confusion and wanted to make sure that people understood that when he sang the song, he was singing it as a devotional song. And when we talked about it, we kind of came to the conclusion that regardless of how people took it, either way, the message was a good one and he was fine with it.
Okay, this is Johnny Cash as featured on the box set Unearthed.
Glory, hallelujah, I shall not be moved. Anchored in Jehovah, I shall not be moved. Just like a tree that's planted by the waters, I shall not be moved. In his love abiding, I shall not be moved. And in him confiding, I shall not be moved. Just like the tree that's planted by the water, I shall not be moved. I shall not be moved. I shall not be moved, just like the tree that's planted.
That's Johnny Cash singing I Shall Not Be Moved from one of his sessions with producer Rick Rubin. We'll hear more from Rubin after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening back to an interview I recorded with Rick Rubin about producing Johnny Cash's American Recording Series. The final album in the series was released today. Now, some of the takes that you've released over the years are recordings that he actually made in your living room. Do I have that right?
Yes.
Not even in your recording studio, but in your living room.
That's correct. The whole first album was recorded in the living room of my house.
And why did when you were recording in the living room, did you do it with the idea that this would be the final takes? This would be what you would release?
Originally not. Originally, they were demos. And then as we were recording in studios and in different places and trying different things, when we listened to all the different things we tried, the living room tapes were kind of the most exciting to both of us. So we continued recording in the living room.
Why do you think that was so? Why do you think the living room tapes were the most exciting?
I think it's because Johnny had made so many albums in the recording studio that it reframed the experience of recording. And it really was just he and I sitting on a couch and him playing me songs. And it had a more personal and intimate and internal feeling about it. It wasn't... I spoke earlier about the performance aspect of playing in front of people, and I suppose being in a recording studio has those same kind of... there's a certain expectation of getting on the mic in a recording studio that there's some kind of permanence about it. Where singing songs in the living room it's really casual. So I think his real, true, casual personality... was something that we were able to do better in the living room environment than in a studio environment. And then as time went on, I put a studio in my house, which has very much of a living room environment.
When did Johnny Cash start getting sick within the period of time you were working with him? I mean, how deep were you into the recordings when it was clear that something was going wrong?
During the recording of the second album, which was called Unchained, was when he started, when it became apparent that he was not well.
How did it, like, what were the first things that made that clear?
We'd be in the studio working and he would get dizzy or he would be unable to sing and have to lay down for a while. And some days he wasn't able to sing and he would just not be himself at all.
What were some of the most difficult parts for him of being sick and vulnerable, somebody who'd been so strong and seemingly stoic, just judging from the records, you know?
Yeah, he was. I think stopping touring was a really big blow to him because he'd been on tour for the last 40 years doing, you know, 200 shows a year. And... I think he felt like he in some way lost his purpose because he was an artist and the thing that drove him was connecting with people and entertaining people and inspiring people. And he felt like one of the main venues for doing that was taken away from him. And I think that was a very, very difficult transition. And probably the reason that he chose to record so much was because that was the part of his career that he could continue on and continue being an artist and continue being creative and continue communicating. And that's one of the reasons that we have the box that we have. If he was still touring, I don't know that we would have been able to record so much.
What was your recording schedule like after he got sick?
We would record as often as he wanted to record. We set up a kind of a home studio at his home, and we had the studio at my house, and we would work in both of them all the time, and as often as he would want us to get together, or sometimes he would record stuff on his own or and send me tapes, and then I would work on them. Sometimes I'd work on tracks and send them to him, and he'd sing them. And we had just kind of an ongoing, we were always working.
Did you live close together?
No, he lived in Nashville, and I live in Los Angeles.
Oh, so one of you was always flying back and forth?
Yes. Well, although we did some, as I said, I would record some tracks at my house and send them to him. He would sing them and send them back, or he would work on, he would cut an acoustic track and send it to me, and then we would add whatever was going to be added to it here. And sometimes we worked long distance as well.
It must be extraordinary for you to know that you produced this extraordinary body of work from an older musician at a time when, you know, you're supposed to be like over the hill. The best work is supposed to be behind you. And this is work that not only changed Johnny Cash's image and you know, got him, you know, Grammy Awards and everything, but it's just such valuable music to have. I mean, I'm so glad we have it.
I agree. And I feel like it's really an issue with our society that we really discard good things before their time just because they get old or look a little ragged. And I don't think age in any way took away from Johnny's greatness. And in many ways, as he got older and even as his voice may have gotten weaker, it somehow was able to convey emotion in an even deeper way. And, you know, we can't discount the wisdom. He had so much wisdom from both the wild life he led. He really led the life of, he led 10 lives during the course of his lifetime, and was so interested in so many things, and was really a researcher, and studied and read all the time, so smart. And he had so much to offer. And the idea that someone like him could be put out to pasture is, it's really a shame and just a terrible mistake.
Rick Rubin, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Rick Rubin, recorded in 2004. The final album from Rubin and Cash's American recording series was released today. It's called American Six, Ain't No Grave. Here's another song from it.
Proudly swept the rain clouds by the cliff, as on it glided through the trees, still following with glee Falaiko, the Ahi Lehuva of the valley. Hello, how, hello, how. Ikeona ona noha ikoli, one fond embrace, ahoy, heya, heya, until we meet again.
Coming up, David Edelstein reviews the French film A Prophet, which is nominated for an Oscar. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. The French director Jacques Audiard won the grand prize at the 2009 Cannes Film Festival for his drama A Prophet, which has also been nominated for an Oscar for Best Foreign Film. The film is set in a French prison largely divided along racial lines between violent gangs of Corsicans and Arabs. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Jacques Audiard is drawn to the bleakest scenarios imaginable, yet something in him fights against gloom and doom. His terrific 2005 film, The Beat My Heart Skipped, was a remake of James Toback's 1978 Fingers, which ended in its hero's damnation. But Audiard embraced the romance at the story's core and gave the man a way out. Now, in his engrossing prison drama, A Prophet, Audiard works with a plot that vaguely resembles Brian De Palma's splattery, cocaine-fueled Scarface about an immigrant at the bottom of the food chain who seizes power through violence. But Audiard regards his hero differently. He doesn't celebrate the man, but he doesn't damn him either. The movie opens the way many tragedies close, with a character forced to choose between his life and his soul. He is Malik, played by Tahar Rahim, a 19-year-old French Arab sentenced to 6 years for assaulting a policeman under circumstances that remain unclear. When he enters the prison, he's tremulous, visibly frightened. Almost at once, he's set upon by the most powerful inmate, an aging Corsican mobster named Cesar, played by Niels Aristrup, who orders him to seduce and slit the throat of another French Arab about to testify at a trial. If Malik refuses, he'll die. If he agrees, his survival is ensured. Still, he tries everything to keep from killing a fellow Arab, from blowing the whistle to getting thrown into solitary confinement. Odiar's camera is extraordinarily intimate. We hover just above Malik's shoulder as he finally acquiesces, as he learns, dribbling blood, to conceal a straight razor in his mouth and to leap from his knees and swing for the jugular. The man marked for death proves to be kindly and attentive, and the violence when it comes is clumsy, garish, gruelingly prolonged. Malik grew up in state institutions and is non-religious, culturally unaffiliated. But now more than ever, he's a man without a country. The Corsicans protect him, but call him a dirty Arab and use him as a servant. The Arabs shun him as a Corsican. Then, for the more than 2 hours that remain of A Prophet, the illiterate Malik learns to read, not just books, but the power structure of the prison and the world at large. It's a strange, gripping, sometimes confusing journey, since Malik's features harden and Rahim's performance becomes more internal. His scenes with the marvelous Aristrup have dizzying cross-currents. Cesar regularly slaps Malik around. Yet as the majority of Corsicans are released from the prison, repatriated under new French laws, he's dependent on the young Arab as a kind of surrogate son. Meanwhile, with stealth and subtlety, Malik, this man without a country, begins to correct, sometimes brutally, the imbalance of his life and forge a new identity as a Muslim gangster. A Prophet isn't another of those washed-out brownish prison pictures. The colors are warm, the vistas wide. Often, almost matter-of-factly, the boundary disappears between the real and supernatural. The film is sometimes hard to follow. When Malik is permitted to leave the prison for 12 hours at a time and begins to form alliances with Italian, Corsican, and Egyptian gangsters, you can't always tell whom he's playing off whom. That's the price you sometimes pay, though, for filmmakers who zig and zag and resist clicking into established grooves. Even when you don't know what Malik is doing, you know he knows. The title A Prophet is ambiguous, since Malik preaches nothing. But his rise is a testament to self-reliance in a malignant universe. The grim central irony is a classic gangster movie manifesto. It's only via prison that its hero finds existential freedom.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and friend us on Facebook at NPR Fresh Air. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for digital media. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, providing schools that work, strategies for 21st century success. Learn more at edutopia.org. And from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR.
What happens when the hip-hop generation revives the forgotten black string band tradition? You get the band the Carolina Chocolate Drops. On the next Fresh Air, their performance and conversation. Their new CD is called Genuine Negro Jig. Join us.